January 15th, 1980 was Martin Luther King Day, and some young folks with the day off from school in Wilmington, Delaware, threw a party. At about 5 p.m., two white 15-year-olds, a male and a female, left the party and headed towards some train tracks. There are some discrepancies between their accounts, but according to both of them, a black man in tan pants and a green jacket chased the young man away before raping the young woman. The young man said that the assailant was a former classmate named Elmer, and the young woman identified 18-year-old Elmer Daniels from a photo array. Then, a search of Elmer's home turned up a tan pair of pants and a green jacket. In addition to the ID and the items of clothing, an FBI agent testified at trial about hairs found on Elmer's pants and the young woman's undergarments that constituted what he called a double match. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I'm John Huffington, a former guest, and we'll have my episode linked in the bio. I spent 32 years in the Maryland Department of Correction. 10 of those years were on death row. During that time, an FBI whistleblower exposed a fellow agent for testifying beyond the limits of science in my case and many others, one of which we will be covering today. I'm so honored to be filling in for my dear friend Jason Flum as we welcome Elmer Daniels. Can you introduce yourself to the audience?
My name is Elmer Daniels, and I'm a 2018 exoneree, convicted in 1980 for a rape that never happened.
And before we unpack all of that, I just want to introduce your attorney who's also joining us, Emeka Igwe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Elmer, before any of this happened to you, I just kind of want to hear a little bit about your life growing up in Wilmington, Delaware.
Okay. I came from a two-parent household. Now, I had my great-grandparents, my grandparents, my mom and dad, big family. I wasn't a bad kid. And I knew right from wrong, and I based all my decisions on not getting an ass whooping.
That's
for real. I'm being honest.
Gotcha.
And that was the 60s and 70s kid growing up.
But you did stray from that guiding principle, at least on one occasion, and did something, well, you know, it was kind of commonplace in the 60s and 70s, right? Joyriding?
Yeah, I went for a joyride.
All right.
That was the only thing that I actually was, as a minor, convicted of. It was on my record. And it was in Ellesmere. I was a young kid and bumped into the van. The keys fell and my light went on. Oh, there's a van. You know, let's see how far you can go in it before you get caught. I got caught.
Now, when you got caught for that, did you do any juvie time?
Yeah, I went to Bridge House. I stayed at Bridge House for 90, maybe 90 days, because you could just go right. And then your parents come get you. You know, so she let me bake for a while, you know, and let me see how I was. And actually, that was enough.
So a little tough love, you know, steered you away from the petty crime. I mean, obviously, joyriding is certainly not a violent crime, but that incident is why the police had your mugshot in January of 1980 when the alleged rape occurred. Emeka, can you fill us in a little bit on the details?
The underlying crime was an alleged rape of a 15-year-old white female who left a party on January 15th, 1980 with another 15-year-old white male. They went to some nearby railroad tracks. When they get there, their stories differ. According to the 15-year-old male, he engaged in sexual intercourse with the 15-year-old white female. The white female denies that she ever had sexual intercourse with the male. Nevertheless, the female claims that while they were talking on the railroad tracks, a black male came up to them. The 15-year-old male ran away. And after he ran away, the black male allegedly held her down and raped her for 2.5 minutes. The black male allegedly had his hands on her neck.
And both the alleged victim, who we'll refer to as GS, and the young man who we'll call KC, both of them said that the alleged assailant was wearing khaki pants and a green jacket. And GS described the alleged assailant as having a big nose and nails that were bitten down as far as they could go. So what happened next?
She goes back to the party and tells people that she had been raped. The police are called. And when the police come, naturally, they want to speak to the 15-year-old male and question him on what occurred. And he gives about 4 different accounts. And the first time he says some male named Jack Smith came up. The police follow that lead, find out that it's false. After about three or four stories that are inconsistent and contradictory and turn out to be false, the police turn around and charge this 15-year-old male with hindering prosecution. They also threaten to charge him with the actual rape itself unless he tells them what really happened. And under that duress, the 15-year-old male says, "It was some guy named Elmer. I don't know his last name, but I was in the same eighth grade math class with him." That's going to turn out to be significant because the name of the middle school was called Byard Middle School. Elmer had, in fact, attended Byard Middle School, but back in 1978, when this 15-year-old male was in middle school, Elmer was in the 10th grade at a nearby high school. There was a 3-year age difference between them. He was 15, Elmer was 18. They weren't in the same eighth grade math class together.
I'm curious, did you even know Casey?
Never met him before. Never met the girl until I walked into the courtroom.
Wow.
That's the first time I actually seen both of them.
So now they go looking for a kid named Elmer that attended Byard Middle School. But the 3-year difference between Elmer and KC should have been enough for the police to see that KC had lied. Again, this time for the very obvious benefit of not being charged in the rape himself. But instead, they pulled Elmer's mugshot. And at this point, GS had already seen upwards of 300 mugshots. And who knows how suggestive this identification process was. In addition, we know from study after study that cross-racial identifications are less accurate than guessing. But nonetheless, that's what we have here. And they got an arrest warrant for Elmer.
35 days into my 18th birthday, a knock on my door, 618 North Harrison Street, City of Wilmington. Our brother opens the door. Police enter and say they were looking for me because they were charging me with the crime of rape. At that time, not knowing what that was, I had to ask the question, what is that? After being explained what that was by my sister, I was like, you know, I didn't know what to think. But I did know I'm going to jail.
So, Elmer, you weren't even there. Where were you when this happened?
Yeah, I wasn't there. I was playing basketball at church across the street from my house. You had to sign in, and people that I was with, their names were on there, and all the childhood friends, the neighborhood, all their names was on there. But they had a problem with me because my name was on the bottom of the list, but it's on the list. Where regards that?
Now, this church basketball court was well over a mile from where the incident occurred.
Yes, but police said I could run from where I live to where the crime happened in 2 minutes. That means 60 seconds there, commit the crime, and 60 seconds back. And he said he drove it and he got there in 2 minutes. So if I was running, there's no way I'm going to get there in 2 minutes.
And then do an assault that lasts almost 3 minutes.
And come back. So we got a total of 7 minutes.
So basically, you were running a mile in under a minute. So that's impossible. Now, this was the pre-DNA era, but a rape kit was performed and physical evidence had been collected. So what can you tell us about that?
There was blood, there was semen, and there was hair evidence. They weren't able to match the blood type to Elmer. They had semen. DNA didn't exist, but there was nothing they could use to match that to Elmer.
And I'm sure, had there been a blood type present in the semen that matched Elmer, they would have made huge smoke about that. But secretor status isn't even mentioned. So we've got the impossible on-foot round trip. The blood type didn't match. The 3-year age difference. As for the hair evidence, there were hairs collected from Elmer's pants, as well as hairs collected from GS's undergarments. And we'll get to that in just a bit. But first, when they tossed your house, they found items of clothing, khaki pants and a green jacket. This is what the alleged assailant was supposed to have been wearing.
They actually found the pants in a third bedroom closet. They were a pair of khakis, but they were old. You know how you put clothes away and you pack them? They went through the house and they found those. They found the jacket in my brother's bedroom on the second floor, which was his jacket. It had his name on it. But they tried to say it belonged to me.
So there was a notebook that was inside the jacket. Fingerprints were lifted from that notebook. There was an FBI agent who testified that he could not exclude Elmer, but he couldn't include him either. And when we got involved, we had them retest those fingerprints, and those fingerprints were negative for Elmer's fingerprints. So that goes to show the lack of evidence that that jacket belonged to Elmer, in addition to having another name engraved on the inside.
So you were really just trying to fit a square peg into a round hole from the very beginning.
The police were eager to find someone. There had been 2 previous rapes by alleged black males of white women back in 1980, and the police wanted to find out if Elmer was a serial rapist, and they actually tried to link him to the previous two rapes, and that came out to be not true. So they dropped that and proceeded to want to prosecute Elmer, we believe, to send a message and to appease the community that we can't hang him like we used to back in the 60s, but we can send a message by giving an 18-year-old male a life sentence.
There was a no bail situation, I'm assuming?
Bail was actually $5,000.
Wow. And did you post that bail?
No, I didn't. I wasn't in financial fortitude to post a bail.
So while you were stuck in jail from January until trial in May of 1980, I understand that the court had appointed a psychologist to make a recommendation on your mental state. And in interviewing you, he raised a red flag, saying, among other things, that, hey, GS had said that her assailant had a big nose and nails that were bitten down to the nub. That wasn't the case with you.
I went in my natural sense of self and state. It was comfortable, and he and I had a conversation. But at the same time, he was observing the things that they said were part of me that weren't. And he made that assertion in his notes.
That court-appointed psychologist actually took the time. He states in his letter, I try not to play detective, but I have to write your honor to state that I believe Elmer Daniels is innocent. And we have that letter. He CC'd the district attorney and Elmer's public defender. And he goes on to list why he believes that Elmer is, in fact, innocent.
Okay, so you have a public defender. How often did you even talk to him? Did you meet?
Well, I met defense attorney Edward Pankowski. By the time I got to trial, I had only seen him twice. But the first thing that he offered me when I met him was a deal. And I'm like, deal for what? You know, and he said, well, you know, judging that they got all the evidence that I see against you, because he had ran all over all the evidence with me that he felt was making me guilty. The first deal was 5 to 15 to life. That was for second degree. I'm like, well, we're going to trial.
Right.
We're going to trial. If they're going to get me, they're going to get me, because I'm going to go down fighting.
So the jury was going to hear from GS and KC, as well as this puff of smoke from the FBI fingerprint analysis about the notebook and the green jacket. And then our favorite, the FBI agent who also testified in my case, Special Agent Michael P. Malone. And he's going to testify about hairs allegedly found on GS's undergarments and these khaki pants that had been packed away in a third bedroom closet at Elmer's house.
I always say that I don't blame the jury for convicting Elmer, because the hair analysis would have had a tremendous impact on anyone. They had this FBI agent who supposedly had all the credentials as an expert and was a prolific testifier on behalf of the FBI. He testified, as you know, all across the country. He appears and he says in Elmer's case that there was a double match. What do we mean by a double match? He said there was hair that was found on the pants when Elmer was arrested that belonged to a Caucasian individual. And there was hair found on the underwear of the victim that belonged to an African-American individual. And he testified to the jury that there was a microscopic match between the hair in the victim's underwear that belonged to Elmer and the hair that was found on Elmer's pants, which belonged to the victim. And he said it was a double match, that this is something he's never even come across. You can imagine the impact that that would have had on the jury. Back then, there wasn't any DNA, but that kind of testimony is equivalent to DNA identification.
Okay, I get the definition of double match, but guess what? If neither one of them is the right hair, then you've matched nothing. You just have two hairs in two different places, or three different places, that actually aren't the same hairs. Am I right in just that basic assumption?
Absolutely, and that's one of the things when we fast forward, when we send the transcripts to the FBI, they had to admit, the special counsel from the U.S. Department of Justice wrote to the Attorney General of Delaware admitting their agent testified, as they put it, beyond the means of science, a.k.a. also known as he lied.
And, you know, he lied. Used that phrase to elevate it to some extreme, like, I've never hardly ever seen this, or, you know, this is a double match. And you get this catchphrase that, like you said, 12 people like you and I are hearing this when you have an FBI agent, suit and tie, J. Edgar Hoover. We're all taught to believe in the infallibility of their work.
Yeah.
Because I had a similar thing. Agent Michael Malone, in my case, was to a 98.9% certainty.
Right.
But we learned later that, one, he probably didn't even do the test himself, and DNA conclusively proved that he was lying.
Yeah. So
I get what you're saying as far as that goes. So everything's stacked against Elmer. We've got these junk sciences going on. Did your lawyer contact the people that played basketball with you?
The guy that ran, the director, he actually testified. He signed in. I knew he was there. Know all his friends. Even some of my friends testified.
But since these people knew you, obviously the prosecution just shot holes in your alibi by attacking their credibility on that angle. But what about the age discrepancy between you and KC? I mean, obviously you guys were not in the same year of school.
The prosecutor presented a middle school teacher to say that Elmer was in the same eighth grade math class. We believe that teacher did in fact teach Elmer, but just years prior. And Elmer also, to make it more confusing, Elmer also had brothers who had that same teacher.
And a sister.
Yes.
We all had him for homeroom.
All had him. So, but Elmer then takes a stand and tells the jury, no, I was not in the same eighth grade math class as Casey. The prosecution then calls us a rebuttal witness, a detective, who is a named defendant in the lawsuit that we have going on now, and he's still alive, who says Elmer was in the same eighth grade math class as Casey. So you can see how the jury would say, well, if he's going to lie to us about being in the same eighth grade math class as Casey, Casey testified to it, the teacher testified to it, and this rebuttal witness came and testified to it, it must be true. And where we fall the prosecutor is, just like we pulled the transcripts, he's an agent of the state. The school districts are agents of the state. He could have easily pulled those transcripts. But they had a narrative, and they were going to follow through on that narrative that Elmer was, in fact, a rapist.
Yeah, that is definitely improper. Did GS take the stand in this case?
She was one of the first witnesses.
What's your analysis of the cross-examination?
Unfortunately, there were several things that he could have certainly explored contradictions, not just in her testimony, but the testimony of KC. One of the big ones was KC's claim that he had sexual intercourse.
Right.
That should have been explored. There was some other evidence that we don't need to get into that shows that she did, in fact, have sexual intercourse, but none of that was explored.
I do want to ask Elmer, it's one thing to have, you know, FBI agents and folk up there, and they're describing evidence and talking about things. It's another thing when it gets personal. How did you feel when you sat there and listened to GS's testimony?
I basically sitting there as an 18-year-old kid is, she's lying. Literally, she's lying. And what could I do about it?
Right.
I have people protecting her interests, then nobody protecting mine. So I had to sit there, watch, listen. I can't explode because it makes it worse. So I had to sit there and swallow it. Right? But at the same time, you can't understand why someone would do that.
So between GS identifying you and Special Agent Malone making his double match, any of the other defense efforts were doomed to fall short.
When they found me guilty, a month later, they sentenced me. I'll never forget it on my sister's birthday. So they give me 45 years to life with the possibility of parole. But the thing about it is they convicted me, sentenced me, offered me a deal in the process, before trial, after trial, gave me time, pulled me back into court 18 months later, offered me a deal.
Pause there for a second. I got to keep up with you on that part of the story.
18 months, they come back with this deal. Now, common sense tell me when they did that, because they did it before trial, during trial, and then you convict me and give me the time, and then you're coming back to offer me a deal. You know what I mean? But then they blamed it on the fact that because I had no real serious criminal history, and due to the lack of physical trauma to the victim, then they didn't feel it was conducive to give me what you gave me. And so all those flags went up. Something's wrong. And that's what I just kept saying to myself. Something's wrong. Why would you come back and offer me a deal? You knocked me in my head and said, that's what I deserve. Somebody in there knew something was wrong, but that somebody couldn't do any more than they were doing. When I went into the penitentiary, it only held 500 people, okay? And you could stretch it at 7. Imagine seeing 3 penitentiaries built, you know, and asking you, do you want to build or be a part? And I'm like, nah, I'm not building anything you're going to put me in, you know? I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. Early into being incarcerated, I wanted to fight you at every cost. First, I'm scared. Second, I'm not going to let you do anything to me, you know? And I learned real early because of a guy that was familiar with my family and knew my father kind of pulled me to the side. He let me know. He said, listen, you're angry, but you know, if you don't change somebody's going to kill you, or you're going to kill somebody because you're angry. And he said, let me ask you something. I said, what? He said, out of all the guys that's in here, who did something to you? And that made sense to me because they were there before I got there. And so there's a code of ethic. There's inmate code of ethic. And then there's the code of ethic for the officers because they want to go home. So what you see, but you don't see it. And in the penitentiary, all you have is your word. I found out that over the course of time, the most important quality that we have as a human being to be able to communicate with people becomes stagnated. We're around the same people every day. We do the same thing 23, 24 hours a day and then turn around, repeat it tomorrow. It's just like getting up, going to work. I guess that's why I like going to work. It's a process. But for me to see all those things, and I'm not going to get into all the violent parts of that because I don't need that to steer my emotions because it does. But I never not thought that I wasn't going to see the other side of the fence. That never entertained my mind. But I knew I was going to be here for a while. My whole mindset was that since I'm going to be here, I might as well go ahead and do what I got to do. I got my high school diploma, started dabbling in everything else that I could, closed myself in that 8x10, and I started opening up those books called Law and Rules and Codes of Ethic. And I started finding out what specific words meant, not even know what layman terms meant till I got back into the courtroom. And I use the terminology. I don't know what he's speaking. He's speaking lingo language. I need to know what he's saying. And that's when I learned to have a judge have them explain to you so you can understand.
So you set yourself on the positive path and got involved in your own legal fight. But what happened in his initial appeal, Amico?
So after he was convicted, he had an ineffective assistance claim. They appointed him an attorney there, but they appointed him another attorney out of the public defender's office.
Conflict.
So that's of course, it's a conflict of interest. It's like a private firm, another associate, you know, going after, you know, another attorney. You know, that's what happened. But anyway, after that was quickly shot down by the judge, Elmer, who, you know, at the time had a 10th grade education and had a life sentence, even though he requested to have appellate counsel. He was denied appellate counsel, and he was forced to fight this case on his own, pro se, for the next 36 years. You know, Elmer's official sentence was 30 years to life. After he hit 30 years, he petitioned for parole. He kept getting denied.
They want you to admit your crime. And that when you do that, you can't take it back. And so that was my biggest issue going through all this, is I wanted something that was rightfully mine, but would I sell my soul to get it back?
Finally, after 35, 36 years, there was a sympathetic African-American female on the parole board who seemed to really listen to what Elmer was presenting to show, in fact, he was innocent. And we believe she advocated for him to be released on parole.
I was paroled November 2015 and had met Emeka on January 26, 2016. I had an expungement summoned up on a church on 5th and Clayton Street. If you were convicted of a crime and your crime is like 5 years old or older, you can have those things removed from your record because that is one of the things that is hindering you from being gainfully employed. And so he got up and spoke my life into existence. Everything that came out of his mouth was literally me. He said, just imagine for a moment that you are a young man and you go to prison. You're 18, 19 years old. And you come out as a 56, 57, 58-year-old man. I'm somewhere around there, 54, somewhere like that. And I'm shaking my head. And he said, and you know, after you come out, your life is basically over. Now you got to get it back together, but you don't know what to do because the one thing that's hindering you is what you actually went to prison for. And so I stood there and waited to talk with him. And when I got the opportunity to say what I need to say, my first question to him was, you know, you spoke my life just now up here. And I just did 35 years in the penitentiary. And I have evidence that proved I've never committed a crime at all. I have it right here in my hands. And I remember the young lady coming to tell him, Mr. Emeka, your seat's ready and people in line waiting on you. And he said, come on. And so I went from the end of his line to the front of his line, got his last card. And all he said was, okay, I'm going to help you. And it cost you nothing. And we've been here ever since.
You know, Elmer was convicted in May of 1980, and I was born in August of 1980. So I feel one of my life missions, reason I'm here on earth, was to cross paths with Elmer and help right the injustice that was done to him.
But unfortunately, you know, instead of being able to just focus solely on clearing his name, your efforts were split. because Elmer got sent back to prison on a parole violation.
When he was released, he was given two conditions. Number one, he had to obtain and maintain employment. And number two was, because he was a convicted sex offender, he had to take certain classes in order to be rehabilitated. So on the first condition, Elmer obtains employment at a local barbecue restaurant. And 3 weeks into working there, that restaurant gets a call from the state police stating that Elmer is a convicted sex offender. And they were coming out the next day to put posters in the restaurant to notify patrons that Elmer was a convicted sex offender. So you can imagine what happens next. The next day, Elmer is brought in and is told, unfortunately, he has to be let go. So despite the fact that they caused Elmer to lose his employment, that was cited as the first violation. The second condition was to take these classes, which Elmer takes all the classes. And upon completing all the classes, he said in order to get a certificate of completion, he had to admit guilt.
And my whole thing was, I'm willing to participate, but if you ask me if I did it, I'm going to say no. You're repunishing me just because I'm simply saying no, but you're not listening to why I'm saying no.
He has a constitutional right to maintain his innocence, but he was told, we're going to find out it's a second violation. So after tasting freedom for 8 months, after being locked up continuously for 36 years, he was sent back to prison with the clear message that unless you're willing to admit guilt, you're not going to see the light of day again.
So Emeka uncovered for you basically the same thing that happened in my case. And if it's all right with you, I just want to do a little bit of a rundown of that history right now and make sure you know everything that was going on at that time.
Go ahead.
So Agent Michael Malone of the FBI, who was their premier hair microscopic examiner, who also became the center and the hub of an international scandal that basically took the FBI lab down where they don't do microscopic hair examinations anymore. But this actually started in August of 1989. There was the guy that ran the metallurgical lab was named William Tobin, and he raised concerns about Agent Michael Malone's testimony in a different case because he knew he was lying, and he brought it up then. And then fast forward a little bit, there was the Oklahoma City bombing case. I'm sure you've heard about that. After that case, a whistleblower came out of the FBI lab, Dr. Frederick Whitehurst. And he wrote letters. He made a lot of allegations. Basically, he was saying that the FBI lab is being coerced into always presenting evidence favorable to the state. They were trying to tell them how to do it. They weren't following best practices. And he raised a lot of issues about Agent Michael Malone. Well, the Inspector General's office, which is above the FBI, launched a big investigation. And in 1997, they issued a report. And they named Agent Michael Malone and said that he consistently misrepresents evidence and testifies outside of his area of expertise. I think, as Emeka said earlier, layman terms, it sounds like you just called him a liar. So I have a copy of that report. I know about it. But I can't do anything with it. It's not enough to go up against an FBI agent and say he lied in my case. You know, it just wasn't enough. Now, what nobody knew, right after that report came out, the FBI themselves launched a new investigation. And they brought in outside forensic scientists to look at every case that Malone had touched. Mine was in that mix. I'm sure yours was. But they never made it public. So the FBI, they sent that to my prosecutor with a letter saying, hey, there's something wrong with the Huffington case. And my prosecutor covered that up for the next 14 years. I would not have known about it if it wasn't for Spencer Hsu at the Washington Post. In 2015, Spencer wrote the article that exposed the whole scandal that was going on with the FBI lab. And at that point, they start scrambling. They know that report was coming out. In my case, they ended up DNA testing the hair, and they were not my hairs. And that's how I wanted rid of actual innocence. But not to get off into that, I'm just saying this started in 1989, really coalesced and formulated in 1997 to 99. And you weren't contacted. They didn't tell you. No. It wasn't until, I think, 2015, after the article came out, where the Innocence Project got involved with the DOJ, Department of Justice. And at that point, they started making some notifications to some defense lawyers. But you and I both, it cost us probably an extra 15 years in prison because they were withholding this information from us.
No, that's the first I heard.
So I'm going to turn to Emeka, who I'm sure knows pretty much everything I just said. You're coming on board. It's 2015. The articles come out. You've got not only hair evidence is questionable, but you have the agent in question, the guy that's at the heart of the whole storm, Michael P. Malone.
So we saw, you know, the Inspector General's report, all the documentation on what was going on. So we knew we had a serious issue. So we sent the trial transcripts to the FBI. They appointed a special counsel who was looking at this case, and he wrote a letter to the Attorney General of Delaware stating, as we said earlier, that the agent had testified beyond the means of science in Elmer's case. And that was cited along with what we talked about earlier with the transcripts showing Elmer was not in the same eighth grade math class as KC.
Not to mention all the other reasons that should have kept them from pursuing Elmer at all. But now, unfortunately, the biological evidence in this case had been destroyed. So there was never going to be a slam dunk on the exoneration through DNA testing. But how did Delaware react to the evidence that you had amassed?
So the Attorney General's office fought tooth and nail to not release Elmer and to give him alternate solutions. And this is a consistent theme that I've seen in a number of wrongful conviction cases. Even if they're going to let you go, the next thing they do is try to mitigate or totally eliminate any potential civil liability that would result in you getting compensated. And one of the ways they do that is never totally exonerate you. They offered him a commutation, which is you're guilty, but we're just going to cut short your sentence. So I want your audience to think about this. If you're guilty, you're going to jump at that. But Elmer was willing to spend the rest of his life in jail in order not to admit to a crime that he knew he didn't commit. And so he turned that down. And so only after we backed them in the corner and they had no choice, did they finally say, okay, we'll agree to overturn the indictment, remove the charges, but we're still not going to say you're completely innocent. And if you're going to get compensated, you're going to have to fight tooth and nail again to get compensated, because Delaware is one of, I think, 12 states that's left that doesn't have any compensation for people who have been wrongfully convicted and incarcerated.
Well, we'll get to compensation in a minute, but first, I really just want to acknowledge what you were willing to do with what you had on the line. I'm just happy for you that you were able to force their hand and win your freedom. What was that day like? I mean, how'd you feel?
They asked me how I feel about it. When he told me, he said that too, how you feel. And then my response was, I don't know. Just this day came and it's here. You know, you thought you would react one way in your mind because it hadn't happened. You're going to do all these things. But when he literally told me and asked me how I felt, I just simply said, I don't know.
That I can relate to. Trust me on that.
Yeah, and I got a whole lot of, aren't you happy?
What's that mean?
Yeah, I am, but I don't grab that. They took celebratory away from me. It's just another day. It's another Christmas. I know the significance. It's just another day.
It's very eerie to have this conversation and you express the exact same sentiment I did. Because I've never talked about that on my release date to anybody. Until you just said that, I was like, yeah, he's nailing it. You're saying exactly how I felt. Everybody's looking for your feelings and you don't have them.
Right. You don't have them. And because you have become immune to it, people think that something's wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you know, inside, and I think you could probably relate, like, I didn't celebrate holidays, birthdays, any of that. And when I came home, I still don't. Mm-hmm. I really don't do much for holidays or birthdays. No. What I started doing was celebrating what I called my Freedom Day, the day I came home, July 22nd. And I was doing it for a number of years, but when I came home, I wasn't fully exonerated. I had to take an Alford plea. That carried on for 10 years. It took me 10 years after being home. I just got mine straight this year. So this year is the first year I've ever been whole. But I had made a statement to a friend of mine last year. I said, I'm not going to celebrate my Freedom Day anymore. Because all I did was trade one prison cell for a bigger one. I still have the stigma. I still am not fully clear. And then this year, I was fully cleared. And I actually got to spend it with, you know, our mutual friend here, Jason Flom, and celebrate it the way it should be celebrated as an honestly free person. And that does mean something. And I know it's an important day to you. And your battle's not over, though. You never got compensated.
No. So right now, December 13th would be 5 years, you know, and December 12th is my birthday. So December, I celebrate two birthdays. So I'm like you. I'm waiting to get to that point where I don't want to celebrate that no right. more, but it keeps me humble. It keeps me conscious of the possibility of it could happen to you again, you know? So I'm conscious of that.
Well, at least you have Emeka by your side. So like you said, your Freedom Day is December the 13th, 2018. They removed the charges but didn't recognize your innocence to mitigate their civil liability. So are you suing them?
Yeah, we sued the FBI, which is the United States government, and we sued the city of Wilmington and their police department. The United States was dismissed from the case after they filed a motion claiming immunity. And the federal judge, to his credit, even though he said, you know, I have to follow the law on immunity, he made the attorneys for the United States apologize on the record to Elmer. But nevertheless, despite the fact that they recognized it was a tragedy, they were not willing to compensate him even a dime.
And neither has Delaware. Now, Elmer, I know that no amount of money could ever make up for what they took from you, but at the very least, it could help you live out the rest of your life, which you still get to do thanks to Emeka.
In the beginning of all this, like I said to Emeka, when I met his wife, Mary Jane, I told him there's not an ocean wide or deep enough for me to even begin to tell him what he has really done for me. And I never cried over this, but it's been 5 years. Some of it's been hard. It's really been hard. But for me, I'm just finding a way to stand up. Just stand there and walk. And I know how I'm doing it, but I'm doing it. And if I could get a couple of men together and I could help them straighten out their life, I'll go for it in a heartbeat, because they need people like us to really give them insight on what you're facing, what you're going to be dealing with. If I help one, I did something. If I help many, then I'm doing a whole lot of something. Someone opened the door for me to come back through. It would be real unfair for me not to try to pay that forward.
You know, I feel that same obligation, because I had a great law firm that got involved in my case, Ropes and Gray, and they got me out. And the only way to repay any of these folk is to live the best life we can live and to pay it forward. Like you just said, I know what you're saying. There's a weight on our shoulders right now to pay that forward so that they feel good about what they did. When they point to you, Emeka points to you and talks about Elmer. He's like, look what Elmer's out here doing. He's taking care of all this business.
Right.
And that's gonna make it all worth it. And people believe in you and people support you for sure.
Yeah. But I hadn't had a chance to look at that reflection. You just gave me that. I'm sitting here and I did all this. I call it crap because it really doesn't mean anything, but I'm doing it.
Because it does mean something. You know you're doing the right thing, just like you knew you were doing the right thing, fighting for your life, never giving up, never surrendering your integrity, your name, your character, your humanness. You know, you hung on to that. And you're here today to give back. And you're going to find your way. And that's how it's going to work. But what can our audience do to help? I know you got a GoFundMe, and they can certainly help you out. And we're going to make sure we put a link for your GoFundMe at the end of this podcast. But overall, either Elmer or Emeka, what can we do as a community here? Where do we need to step up?
Well, one of the things is we need to get a bill in Delaware to help those who have been wrongfully convicted and incarcerated get compensated. Elmer was instrumental in getting a bill drafted. We got it through a committee in the State House of Delaware, but the bill was never put on the floor. So we want to put pressure on Governor John Carney, the leaders of the Delaware Senate and the Delaware House of Representatives, to say Delaware should join the majority of states in having a wrongful conviction and incarceration bill. So that's one of the things that we can do to help make sure someone like Elmer is treated fairly. You know, when Elmer was released, he was just released with a shirt on his back in the middle of winter, given 3 days worth of diabetic medicine to the point where once that medication ran out, it went to a diabetic shock. And no resources have been provided for him. No one's checking on him. So we want all of that to change. And Elmer is an advocate for that.
He's a warrior. Well, I got to say, folks, this has been an honor for me to be a part of this conversation, to meet both of y'all. Elmer, you're my hero. I want to thank Wrongful Conviction and Jason and Connor and everybody for letting me do this. At this point in time, we always like to give our guests that last word, whatever's on your heart, whatever's on your mind. Wrap it up for us. Tell me what you think.
Thank you guys for giving us a platform to talk about this important issues, because unfortunately there are many other Elmers out there across prisons, across America. And by casting light on the injustice that goes on, hopefully we can make a change. Hopefully we can make a change in laws to say that there should never be a time bar, procedural time bar on innocence. If someone is innocent and has evidence to show that they're innocent, they shouldn't be precluded from presenting that in court, which is what happens a lot of times. The merits never get heard. States should not be allowed to destroy evidence, like happened in Elmer's case, where someone who's facing a life sentence has forensic evidence destroyed so they cannot scientifically exonerate themselves. So by casting the light on cases like Elmer and the other cases that you're doing, you're making a difference and causing people to really think that we can make a change in our criminal justice system.
Okay. I think given a little bit more time, I know that I'm going to be okay. It's nice to meet you, John. This is the kind of thing that I aspire to want to always do, be able to talk about it. I'm down because I know that I'm a voice. I know that they can't change, you know, what has been done, but I can change to prevent it from happening to someone else. So with that, I want no more victims. I don't want no more guys going, if we can get one thing right, that's the one thing we need to get right. You know, it's easy to put me there, but it makes it hard for me to get myself out when you don't give the whole truth. You know, give up truth. If I'm judged by a jury of my peers, I never seen one of those people that I grew up in my neighborhood sitting in that jury pool. Those are jury of my peers. I have to go back to that neighborhood. So those are the people that I have to go back to. Those are the people that have to deal with me. But I didn't see those people because those people knew who that young man was. That's what we deal with.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'm your guest host, John Huffington. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, as well as the production staff, Connor Hall, Andy Chelsea, and Kathleen Fink, with research by Shelby Sorrells. The music in this production is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow Wrongful Conviction across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Huffington John. And you can find my book, Innocent, An Obscene Miscarriage of Justice, at johnhuffington.com or wherever books are sold. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.